1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The first Donald Trump criminal trial will start as scheduled April 15th. The federal judge in New York denying a defense motion to delay. This is the election interference, hush money, porn star trial. Mr. Trump denies wrongdoing. Another judge gave Mr. Trump a lower amount to post bond for his appeal of the financial fraud civil judgment against him. The head of Boeing says he'll step down at the end of the year. ABC's Gio Benitez.
It comes amidst increased scrutiny over Boeing's production after an investigation found that Alaska Airlines' door plug blew out because four key bolts were missing, and an FAA audit obtained by the New York Times finding Boeing failed 33 of 89 product audits.
Gasoline prices went up on a national average 7 cents a gallon for regular the past week, says the Energy Department, $3.52. Russian President Putin now blaming radical Islamists for Friday's Moscow terrorist massacre. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Republicans are faulting Northeast Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher for leaving the U.S. House before his term is over. Roger Roth tells the Journal Sentinel he's disappointed by Gallagher's decision. Andre Jacques says he'd be in favor of a special election. As it is, the seat would be vacant from late April to early January. Officials are investigating complaints of phony and forged signatures on recall petitions targeting Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Dawn Haggerty says she called the Racine County District Attorney's Office after her signature was forged.
And I also called the Elections Commission to ask if there's a way to get my name redacted off the list because this doesn't represent me.
Haggerty spoke to WISN-TV's Up Front. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Connect the dots. Would you dip into your retirement savings to make a loan to climate-polluting oil, coal, and gas companies? Well, you already have if you're a member of Wisconsin's public employee retirement system. Go to climatesafepensionswisconsin.org. Sign the petition. Common sense investments, not financing polluters. Future generations will thank you for visiting. That's climatesafepensionswisconsin.org.
At Civic Media, we encourage active
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about, lots going on in Trump world. But interestingly enough, the good folks at CREW, Citizens for Responsible and Ethics in Washington, they came out with a bombshell on Friday that said that the big institutional investor in the SPAC that's merging with Truth Social, a hedge fund co-founded by Republican mega donor Jeffrey Yaz. It's also, they're saying, could give Trump about a $3.5 billion windfall. Also, what's interesting is while Yaz is a part of this, he's also a major investor in ByteDance, the company that owns TikTok. Interestingly enough, and this could be, I'm just throwing this out here, and I'm clearly not the only one that's thinking this, but the fact that Yaz is a big investor in ByteDance, might be bailing him out, Trump out, with his Truth Social, could be behind Trump going, wait a minute, no, we're going to flip-flop on the TikTok ban. Because if you remember, wasn't so thrilled with it before, but a huge payday? Might be there. Now, Yaz is the biggest political donor in this country in this cycle. I think it was something like $46 million he's doled out. And it's quite remarkable that we're fighting over over TikTok. And look, I've gotten a lot of responses from people, you know, telling me that, you know, I'm right, I'm wrong, you know, all over the map. And I keep saying, look, TikTok's a very small part of what I believe needs to happen. We need to be fighting for domestic production, for domestic consumption. We need home ownership, home rule, if you will. And, you know, not just for national security reasons. No, you need to have a manufacturing base so that you can build stuff in the event bad things happen. That's a no-brainer. But for me, it goes further. The idea of being able to control your own production, the idea that you can, you know, ramp up or slow down to meet needs and demands and times, important for economic stability, if nothing else. But you throw into that, when you have productive capacity, when you have factories and you have people who are tinkerers, you get a lot of innovation and technological advancements out of it. The closer you are to the production, the closer you are to fixing or changing or advancing technology, getting that competitive edge, which is why we, for a couple of generations, the home of innovation, as we've lost that, sadly, I fear we're going to lose it. Now, coming out of the pandemic, you go, the lesson we should have learned is that we're way too dependent on the rest of the world, that we should be producing our own stuff. Just, you know, national security, supply chain, resilience, we shouldn't have to go any further. We should not have to go into the fact that we need to create jobs for workers here in America instead of, you know, making sure that China's at full employment. Maybe thinking about it here at home. The idea of having some quality control over it. Maybe we don't have baby formula with melamine in it. Maybe the toys that we get for our kids aren't painted with lead paint. You know, maybe it's actually better. What's interesting is in this idea of planned obsolescence. You buy something and like a week, 2 weeks, 6 months later, it's junk, it's broken, you got to go buy another one. That's by design. Keep you consuming. And I hear people all the time say, you know, I'd be willing to pay a little bit more if it just lasted like it did during our grandparents' era. You know, when we made stuff here at home. Now, you know, the fact is that, you know, manufacturing jobs pay higher wages. That's something we should want. It's going to help our save Social Security, help save our unemployment, help save the programs that we have in place. Not to mention the fact that, you know, you're going to get workers who have skills. And skilled workers do what? They drive innovation and productive gains. It's a giant snowball forward. If you want to have some environmental impact, produce at home so you have control over it. There's so much to this. Our massive trade deficit, the fact that we're spending dollars overseas that eventually have to come back here, and this is one of the big parts of this. You know, we're buying trillions of dollars over the last couple of decades in goods that people aren't buying from us. So they're holding dollars. And as we know, the dollar is the reserve currency. So that money has to come back here. They have to buy something. And what are they buying? Well, the fact of the matter is that you look at what Chinese firms have been doing. They've been buying us up. So our frivolous consumption of cheap, you know, the Walmart slogan of, you know, lower prices, better living. No. That money comes back here and buys up farmland, buys up factories, buys up communities, buys themselves into our colleges and into our institutions. And I had someone tell me, well, you're obsessed with China. Yes, I am obsessed with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, my red hat friends love to accuse Joe Biden and Democrats of being communists while they're defending actual communists. That's the bizarre part in all of this. And for me, Biden is doing the right things, is moving us away from what has gotten us into this trouble. Strategically bringing back manufacturing of chips. Desperately need those in this day and age. But steel is a huge part of that as well. Virtually everything you build has steel inputs. And we should be, I don't know, having a national discussion about what reclaiming manufacturing, about Made in America really means, not just the slogans that they put on signs going, oh, look, this t-shirt, Made in America. But actually doing something about it. And this president is, and I've been saying this for the last 2 years, he's moving us away from the same neoliberal nonsense that has caused such harm, moving us away from the supply side voodoo Reaganomics that has caused so much harm to the American working class, and not getting credit for it. That's the problem I'm having. So, you know, when we come back, I'm going to have Roxanne Brown from the Steelworkers here to share some thoughts on why the Steelworkers have endorsed Biden. But understand, every labor union in this country should be, because guess what? It really is about bringing jobs home, about bringing manufacturing home, and about having a strong economy, strong communities, a strong country. That's something shouldn't be red hat or blue hat. Should be red, white, and blue hat. Want to hear your thoughts? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, the United Steelworkers endorsed Joe Biden for re-election. And I got to tell you, not surprising. Every union in this country should be lining up and saying, that's our guy. The guy who found Obama's comfortable shoes and went out and marched on that picket line. The guy who's appointed good people to the National Labor Relations Board, to the Department of Labor. The guy who has said, hey, you know, it's the middle class that built America, but it's unions that built the middle class. That guy, in my view, should be reelected. And here to share some thoughts on, well, why they endorsed Joe Biden for reelection, I've asked Roxanne Brown to come talk with us. She's a vice president with the United Steelworkers. Roxanne, thanks for taking time for us.
It's my pleasure, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, for me, it should be almost a no-brainer that every labor union in this country lines up with a debt of gratitude to this president and say, look, you're our guy, we're on board, but I'm not putting words in your mouth. Why'd you guys endorse him?
First of all, I'll just say, I agree with what you just said. I think that what we have seen over the last almost 4 years is a guy who has our back as workers all across this country in Joe Biden. And, you know, he doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk, quite literally. You mentioned him walking on the picket line, right? The UAW strike line. That's never happened at any time in US history has a sitting president ever walked a strike line. So that alone, I think, for us as a labor movement is a sign that this person really believes in us and our values. And, you know, just speaking as the steelworkers, one of the things that we have been asking for decades, Rick, and this goes back all the way to former steelworker president Lynn Williams, who testified before Congress in the 1980s, asking for an industrial policy. At our core, we're an industrial union. We're, you know, very diversified. We have 50,000 members in healthcare. We represent school bus drivers. We're literally all across the economy. But, You know, our DNA is that we're an industrial union. We've been asking for this for decades. We have one, finally. Now, because of a president and an administration that made it a priority. And it started with the creation of a Made in America office that exists at the White House and kind of continued through to the infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the Chips and Science Act. All of these pieces are doing what we've been asking for forever, which is to not just revitalize domestic manufacturing, but bring it back home.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I was thrilled that they created that office, and even more thrilled that they put my friend Celeste Drake in charge of it.
Yes. She's awesome.
She's fabulous. And look, it's something that we've needed to do for a very long time. And I don't know, and I've had these conversations recently because of the whole TikTok dust up, but I've had these conversations recently about the idea of reclaiming manufacturing and reshoring that manufacturing and beginning to think about, you know, what's it going to take to rebuild that productive power that we once had that we didn't lose. We know exactly where it is, but we did give it away. And it's going to be a fight to get it back. But finally, someone who's not just talking. Like, we had a guy who, you know, every week was infrastructure week, every week was manufacturing week, every week was something, but didn't actually do anything. Joe, not saying much, but getting a lot done.
Totally. And, you know, I think you hit the key question, right? What does it take to actually get us there? Acknowledgement, right? Acknowledging the fact that we've not lost it all, right? But we've lost a lot of our capacity in terms of industry. And so acknowledging that and then being willing to actually bring it back. And so that's where we are right now. There's an acknowledgement that our steel industry, our aluminum industry, our cement industry, tire, rubber, energy, best in the world. So what do we do to make sure that these backbone industries are going to be here as we're now going into this clean energy economy, right? And we've been talking about it as the industrial revolution of our time. So just like these industries and our members helped build this country, today they can do the same. And so this industrial policy that we're talking about right now, you and I, will make sure that our steel industries can provide the steel, now that we have an infrastructure bill, for the bridges that are going to be rebuilt and that have already been rebuilt, for the roads that are going to be rebuilt, for the transmission systems, right, that are going to be kind of built all across the country, and the water infrastructure systems. You know, the infrastructure bill was the largest investment in our nation's water infrastructure ever. Our members make ductile iron pipe at McWane. Their pipe is going to go into those infrastructure systems, largely because this administration also strengthened Buy America requirements in each of these policies to make sure that as taxpayer dollars are used to build this stuff, that domestically sourced products are used for those systems. And you can't get better than that, Rick. No. You just can't.
Well, as I say all the time, domestic production for domestic consumption. We should be making what we need, and we trade for the things that we can't make, which are very few things, but we should be making it here at home. And all of these investments that we're making for the future should be the creating the jobs of today so that we can have a future. But, you know, here's the thing. We had a guy who wore a red hat that talked about making America great again. And this is the stuff, this is the secret sauce that made this country great. This is the secret sauce that, you know, my grandparents came back from fighting World War II and built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. And they did it because, well, we produced, we invested at home, and we did it with union labor. And I think Joe Biden gets that to his core, whereas the other guy, not so much.
And, you know, I think you said it best. Union jobs, right, across all industries are the pathway to the middle class. That is how we help to make this country stronger, better, not just for current generations, current, you know, folks, but for future generations as well. And I think one of the little talked about things is that unions are at an all-time high right now in terms of popularity. People recognize, especially having gone through the pandemic and faced a lot of unfairness on the jobs, right? A lot of safety challenges on the jobs. They recognize that unions are a way to take back that power, number one, to make sure that they're safe at work, but also to kind of bring themselves into kind of economic security and prosperity. And so we're seeing now that union density is increasing in key places around the country, which is wonderful. You know, the Biden administration has built some really strong labor protections into a lot of these policies as well to help us get there even faster. So it's kind of a time when we're pinching ourselves because we've never experienced anything like this in the policy space before, where legislators actually want to help unions and workers.
Now, I told someone the other day, I'm giddy about this administration.
Yeah.
Because, look, it's what I've been talking about on this program for almost 19 years. It's the kind of investments we need to be doing. It's the kind of investments in our infrastructure, in our manufacturing, and in our people. So, you know, for me, this is moving in the direction that I've been talking about for years. Finally, someone's doing it, and we're talking about it in the right ways. So the question I have then is, you know, how do you pitch this to your members? Look, I'm a member of a legacy union where a lot of people are entrenched in, you know, I make good money because the union fought for really great wages and I've got great benefits. I'm okay. And they think they're, you know, of a different mindset because it's all about tax cuts. How do you talk to those, to your members, and say, look, the future is what this administration is doing?
I think I think a few things. First, we have to ask people to really look at what's been done over the last almost 4 years. Don't look at it with red colored glasses, but really, really pay attention to the policies that have been passed over the last almost 4 years and what's been embedded in those policies in terms of, again, industrial focus in terms of revitalizing domestic manufacturing, labor standards and protections. Look at the actions that have been taken by this administration in terms of having a former labor lawyer, labor side attorney, being the general counsel at the NLRB and Jennifer Abruzzo, right? And look at what's happening in your communities. And to me, in our union, I think the key thing that we need to communicate with our membership is directly how they are being impacted at the local level. Because we can talk about the esoteric stuff at the top, but if folks don't feel it at home, then it really doesn't matter, right? So if I go down to, you know, to Texas and I talk to our folks at McWane about the pipe that they're making that's going into water infrastructure, and I talk to them about how they're expanding capacity and ramping up production and how that's directly tied to the infrastructure bill, that's a win. And that's a win that they see themselves in. If I go up to North Carolina, same thing. And I talk to our members at Corning about the fiber optic cables that they're making and how that's going into our grid systems and how that's, you know, ramping up production at their facilities and creating jobs at their facilities. And we go around the country and we do that at all of our facilities who are benefiting from these policies, these industrial policies that have been passed. There's no way that a person can say they're not winning in this moment. And that the wins that they're experiencing right now have not been brought to them by this current administration.
No, 100% with you. 100% with you. And you brought up Jennifer Abruzzo's name, and I use her a lot. She's got my vote. You throw her, Lena Khan in there, you throw Jonathan Cantor, you throw Catherine Tai in there. These are people doing the work for working people.
That's right. You know, and Julie Sue, right, who has not yet been confirmed as Secretary of Labor, but is acting, and, you know, who stepped in after Marty left the Department of Labor. She is, to her core, a believer in workers.
Yep.
And she is working so hard every single day to help workers make gains in their workplaces all across this country, and has not been confirmed yet. She's just hanging out there. You know, but she's someone who really, really, really believes in workers and in our values.
No, I'm right there with you. I got to ask you this, though, because, you know, obviously the endorsement of President Biden last week came, you know, a couple of days after he came out with the statement that we have to maintain a strong American steel companies. We have powered by American steel workers. He said, I told steel workers, I have their backs, and I meant it. He said U.S. Steel has been an iconic American steel company for more than a century, and it is vital for it to remain an American steel company that is domestically owned and operated. This is the kind of stuff that I'm talking about. You know, again, the whole TikTok dust up, you know, is just a small, tiny piece in a much larger situation of saying, hey, we have to have productive capacity here at home that we control, especially coming out of the pandemic. So for me, this was a really big thing. But was this part of the endorsement, or was this just a little bit of adding on the top?
Honestly, it was the cherry on top, you know. The president saying that last week was just a continuation of the support that he has had for not just steelworker members and our industries, but domestic manufacturing writ large. He believes in this country. He believes in manufacturing workers all across this country. He believes we do it the best, most efficient. He believes in domestic industry and believes in making sure that domestic industry remains as strong and as vital as possible. And, you know, his statement last week was really just a doubling down of his beliefs and what we know as the steelworkers. And, you know, we appreciate the support. Again, I talked about steel as one of our backbone industries. He knows that. And he knows that we need a strong domestic steel industry, not just for helping to build out this economy that we're in right now in terms of clean energy, but for national security. That steel goes into our naval ships, into our ground combat vehicles for the Army, all of which steelworker members make.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, it really was just, like I said, the cherry on top. And another example of how much he believes in steelworker members and steelworker industries. And, you know, it's a very clear example of that. And I think anyone who would say otherwise is not paying attention.
No, we've talked about this, and I've gotten a number of responses from people saying that this is a negative thing, in that, you know, we're turning protectionist. We're remaking the same mistakes that they made before the Great Depression. And I said, no, I don't think we're doing bad things. I go, look, I'm a protectionist. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. I don't have a big moat around my house. But I think we need to start thinking in terms of how do we protect our industries? How do we protect our workforce? How do we as a country kind of move away from the neoliberal thought of, you know, open border, free trade, and let our manufacturing go to the cheapest labor place, and maybe start having a conversation about, hey, maybe it's going to cost a little bit more, but with American labor and American inputs, it's going to be a better quality product. So you might not have to buy it every 6 months like we have to do with this cheap garbage we get from China.
That's right. And why would we want to continue selling our domestic industry? Why would we want to continue that pattern of behavior? You know,
our capitalism, Roxanne, it's capitalism.
It's capitalism. Yeah. But you know what? You know what's on the other side of that? Our union has spent years upon years utilizing our nation's trade laws by either bringing cases to or joining domestic industry with cases at the International Trade Commission. And when you bring a case to the ITC, you have to show injury. Former President Leo Girard would often say that in order to win a case at the ITC, you have to lose. And that means you have to show that you've lost jobs and you've lost capacity. We've been doing that since the 80s across so many domestic industries. Yeah. We wanted to stop. And this president and this administration understands that, which again goes back to the industrial policy, that pattern of having to go back constantly to the ITC to file these cases because we've lost so that we can just stem the tide a little bit is not a case for victory. It's a temporary salve. And so the industrial policy that we have right now, we need to build on that. you know, they're right now pretty words on paper. So the work that our union has to do is to make sure that it's realized. And that's what we're doing right now. We're holding the Biden administration's feet to the fire, making sure that we actually do revitalize these industries and we do bring jobs and industry back to the United States. That's the work right now. And it's work that we're excited to do.
No, I'm 100% with you. In fact, you know, we did a Working Class Heroes tour and we went into a lot of communities that were harmed because of our bad trade policies and the jobs that were lost, the communities were broken. This is, for me, the sales point going into November. And good on you guys for endorsing President Biden. I appreciate you taking some time for us. And I'd love to have you back and pick this up again down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Thanks so much. Roxanne Brown, Vice President of the United Steelworkers. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you think the country's ready for the idea that, you know, maybe we're going to pay a little bit more, but it's going to be better quality? I got to tell you, you know, I get Facebook memes all the time of the garbage that we get. Maybe now's the time. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy and rainy night, windy too, with gusts of 40 miles an hour, a low in the mid-40s. Showers and maybe a rumble of thunder tomorrow, a high to the mid-50s and staying breezy. Sunshine returns for Wednesday, high temperatures climb into the mid-30s. Right now it's 49.
Being blind doesn't always look how others may think. Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support and where I can be seen.
Innovative research, educational resources, supportive community.
The Foundation Fighting Blindness is leading the charge in finding treatments and cures for blinding diseases. Learn more at fightingblindness.org.
A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here are a couple of stories you can file under the "I really don't care" and "why is this news?" But evidently, RFK Jr. gonna announce his running mate this week. Yep, it's coming. We're gonna find out who RFK Jr. is gonna pick as his losing VP. And, you know, could be. Their names go down in history as the ones who, I don't know, throw the election. Also, George Santos, if you were wondering, he has left the Republican Party. He's now, I guess, going to run as an independent. And really? I cannot wait for that campaign to happen. Oh, the fun, the entertainment. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day and maybe some George Santos quips. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think? George Santos has left the party. Do you think they care?
Well, somebody must have paid him. You know, he does those $500 face things, whatever he does. Sings happy birthday to you or something.
I don't know who would pay him.
Republicans. Maybe they paid him to get out.
Could be. I'm saying. Could be. So who do you think on the inside for RFK Jr.'s VP?
It's not me, I can tell you that. You know, I don't know if you know this. Are you aware that he started the conspiracy theory that I fixed the election for George Bush in 2004?
No. Google it. Did you?
Oh, yeah. I was. If I did, I wouldn't have been in his prison for 17 months, I'll tell you that much.
Well, there's truth.
Or I'd have had a big Swiss bank account, one of the two. I don't have that either.
Wow, I didn't know RFK went the kookery. I guess I do know that the kookery went back that far.
Well, what he did, and it's very interesting, real quick, is, by the way, I had a phone call years back, and a friend of mine's like, RFK's got somebody bad mouthing you on HBO or something. And so RFK talked somebody into bringing this up. And his theory was, as you know, the Help America Vote Act, which was done by Steny Hoyer and I, and also Ted Kennedy, the late Ted Kennedy, Mitch McConnell. He says that bill is what led to the ability to elect George Bush and fix the computer systems. So that's where it came from in his mind. So I was part of that conspiracy theory, so I'm not going to be the VP.
Right.
Now, if he really believes, though, that I did that, then he ought to pick me so I can fix this election for him. Think about that.
You know, with all this talk of fixing elections, before it was just, you know, there was some fringe complaints. Now, you know, look, you've got people who still believe that the 2020 election was rigged.
Sure.
Rona McDaniel's not one of them. I don't know if you saw it today on Meet the Depressed with this Kirsten Walker. She asked Rona McDaniels, can you say, as you sit here today, did Joe Biden win the election? And McDaniel said he won. He is the legitimate president. And Welker said, did he win fair and square? McDaniel said, fair and square. He won. It's certified. It's done. And Welker goes, well, Rona, why has it taken you until now to be able to say that? And she went into this whole story about, well, it's all Trump. Trump's the GOP. Nobody wants to cross Trump. Interesting little tidbit.
Right. And wanting to defend her for a second, in the sense that when she was at the Republican National Committee, I mean, she could have done the right thing and said what she actually believed, but she knew if she did, she would have been thrown out quicker than she was. They got her, and then what, 60 of the 200 employees were hatcheted in one day.
Right.
So that'd have put her out a lot quicker if she had the word.
But you at least had your dignity. I mean, I got to tell you, this, okay, now I've come around to the reality. Now I'm going to tell the truth after all of the things that you did for years. I mean, we're 4 years into this and still, still now just coming out with it. And that's my problem.
Right. Well, here's the thing about it too. You're right. Number one, if she wanted to, you know, keep her integrity and dignity, she would have said after the election that it was not the case. And then if he fought to get her out of there, she could have fought it or she could have quit. But look, there's been a string of it. Ted Cruz, his father killed Kennedy. I'm not saying that, but Trump said it. Comments about his wife.
Yeah, called his wife ugly.
Made fun of Marco Rubio, who's trying to audition for VP, made fun of him. You know, I wish I had a glass of water right now. I would drink that water. Everybody forgot about that.
Remember no, I didn't.
Did the water thing?
Yeah, no, I remember.
I didn't either. I said that the other day on one of the other stations. They're like, oh, that's right. I forgot about that. But, you know, he said he is, you know, forgiving. And then, of course, there are tons of people who ran and are currently running who called Trump a lunatic, a Hitler. And all of a sudden, they're getting endorsed by him. You know, so, yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah, since you brought up Rubio, he was also on the Sunday shows. He was on with Jonathan Carl over at This Week and really did a great job interviewing for the VP spot. Evidently, according to Little Marco, when Trump was president, everything was wonderful. The world was at peace. We were all holding hands. Mass prosperity. The world was safer, was better, happier. The sun shined brighter. Children smiled more. It was amazing back then, except for that, you know, that year at the end. But, you know, everything else, perfect.
Look, if Rubio actually was part of the Trump ticket and became the VP, and they won, and he actually became the vice president, I promise you, within about 6 months, there wouldn't be sunshine. There wouldn't be a happy day in Marco Rubio's life. Just ask Pence.
Yep.
See what he thinks. All right?
No, I'm going to say the same thing I said about Kevin McCarthy wanting to be speaker. I want this for Marco Rubio. I want him to be VP. I want him to get, I want him to be on that ticket. I want this for him. Because I want him to have to endure the abuse that comes with being anywhere near Trump when things go bad.
Now, you know who you really want on that ticket, though. Think about it. Marjorie Taylor Three names.
I do.
You do. You know you do. Yeah. For a lot of reasons. One, she would destroy the ticket in 30 days. But a lot of other, you know, comical reasons. You would like to see her on that.
She would make Sarah Palin look like a smart choice.
Right, exactly.
But since you brought up Marjorie Three Names, she's got herself in the news again. This time she's filed a motion, but not an actual, it's a motion, but we're not going to move on the motion to vacate the chair against Mike Johnson, the current speaker. And I think Democrats will bail him out if she does, which is why I don't think they've gone forward on it. But I'm curious, you know, what sense does this make?
Well, I can tell you from the inside in Congress, and I mean, I can't claim to have spoken to a vast percentage of members of Congress, but I can guarantee you, after speaking to some Republican members and staff, there is a fury at her, for the most part, not by everybody, but for the most part, they are furious with her. She stepped on the message. She's, you know, going to continue to step on the message. And what she did is she got her, you know, her day in the sun. She likes to do these, you know, crazy things, and she did it again. Now, the House Democrats are not going to throw this speaker out over that bill. And that's what she's filing this, you know, motion over. Now, she also said, I watched her press conference, and she said, well, I don't want to cause chaos. Well, she has. And she doesn't want to do this. Well, she has. But what she's doing is, you know, she's using this as a warning. Then she's going to go around, think about this for a second, and informally, I know this for a fact, she's going to go around and informally talk to people. Well, what about this person? What is she going to do then? Start to take a vote count and go member to member? She might.
Yeah.
Well, what about that person? She's going to do this. She knows she can't throw him out. Now, I think the rest of them are smart enough, I think, to know that if they do this at her whim and enough members vote against him, even with the Democrats bailing him out, which they rightfully should. I wouldn't criticize them for it, because this is a budget bill that, you know, had a bipartisan vote. But if they do bail him out, and then she attempts to do this, she's not going to win, but she will cause the majority to switch, I believe, to the Democrats, because the Republicans won't be able to govern.
Right.
They won't be able to do that. It's been barely possible now. There's another resignation out of Congress. I think it was today or yesterday. And they want to leave. It's from Wisconsin.
Mike Gallagher.
Gallagher.
Yep.
And that leaves Speaker Johnson with one vote margin. One. So just think of the possibilities of chaos.
No,
he can't pass anything with the Republican majority.
No, and this is where, again, you know, I think, you know, coming into November, voters have seen over the last, you know, year and three quarters, just what their priorities are, and their priorities are chaos. I mean, they haven't gotten anything done other than, well, chaos.
Well, the other day, somebody had messaged me, and they said that, you know, she was a patriot, she was a true conservative, she was a true Republican. And on one of the shows that I do, I addressed this issue. To me, Marjorie Taylor Greene is literally the worst Republican in America. She is not in favor of the Republican Party, by the way. She can say all day long, you know, she's a patriot and doing the right thing. Marjorie Taylor Greene, you have to remember this. She doesn't care if there are 50 Republicans in Congress. She doesn't care if they lose all those seats, as long as they're 50 pure people.
Yeah.
Then she would sit back and complain about everything all day long. That's what she...
You're right on all of this. And, you know, what's amazing to me is, you know, and this is where, you know, my mind goes into these weird spots, is that it seems to me that She just wants attention at every turn. And, you know, it's one of these things that I just, and I think Bob's right in this, that it's about her more than it's about the party. It's about her more than it's about governance. It's about her more than it's about, you know, getting anything accomplished, helping people, any of that stuff. It's really all 100% about her and what, you know, what she's doing in all of this. It's all about her, Bob. And it's not about getting anything done. It's not about making lives better. It's not about governing. It's about none of that.
It isn't. You know, like I've said many times, she doesn't care about the majority. She doesn't care if there's 10 of them. Pureness is what she's about. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
We all know it. You can see through it. This isn't a patriot. Like I said, she is the worst Republican in America. If she was a Democrat, she'd be the worst Democrat, because she's willing to sacrifice her party for her own goal, which is publicity.
Yeah.
She wants to be the crazy one. She likes it.
No, and I keep saying, like, I like her there because she shows who the Republicans are. They haven't put her in her place. They haven't said, no, we're not following this chaos. They follow along. And that shows me that they have no spine. They have no core values. They have no belief structure. It's all about just keeping a job. And that's what's frustrating, because here right. we are again. How many of these shutdown threats do we have to go through? We're the most powerful nation in the world, the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest moment. And we have a government that is wholly ineffective. You don't run a lemonade stand like we run Congress. And yet somehow, I'm not hearing to throw the bums out yet.
Well, I mean, if she continues, she will change the majority. All right. She won't increase it. She'll change it.
So, you know, on this budget front, I mean, there's talk of potentially a limited shutdown. Is this what you're hearing?
I mean, there's a potential for it, but I think that it'll progress. The bills will come together. I don't think there'll be a shutdown of sort. If anything goes haywire, it would be, you know, a temporary type of thing. They put the tough bills together. So I think it'll be fine for now. Who knows down the road?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But wow. Lastly, I saw this interesting article over at USA Today. And I thought, I remember politics not being so coarse. And they were talking about how, you know, Trump has normalized swearing and how you're starting to see more politicians using profanity. Trump, yeah. He swears all the time. Is this a good thing?
Well, look, let me use President Biden's commercial as an example. And by the way, there's nothing to it, but I just want to mention something. In the president's commercial, he says, what the hell is he saying? Now, years back, you wouldn't have the word hell in a... an ad at all. Again, Biden is the least offensive of this. Let me make that perfectly clear. Trump's all over the place. But it's become a normal, starting to become a normal thing in politics. I wish it would go the different direction. I don't care what Trump's saying. It's starting,
alert from
starting
system
to
UI
become
server.
A normal thing.
Low battery.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I think we're being told it's time. Bob, as always, I appreciate the words, the thoughts. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Bob Ney. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1911. It was one of the most tragic days in U.S. labor history. 146 mostly Jewish and Italian women died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City. The death toll was so high because exits were blocked or locked and basic safety precautions were not taken in the sweatshop. Trapped by the flames, some women chose to leap out the windows to their death. Bodies fell from the sky with such force that the sidewalk cracked below. In the aftermath of the tragedy, labor organizers and social reformers pushed for workplace safety reforms. The public reacted with grief and horror at what had occurred. Moses Rosenfeld, who was known as the poet laureate of the slums and sweatshop, captured this grief in a poem he published in Yiddish on the front page of the Jewish Daily Forward 4 days after the fire. Part of the translated poem read, "Sisters mine, O my sisters, brethren, hear my sorrow. See where the dead are hidden in dark corners, where life is choked from those who labor. Oh, woe is me, and woe is to the world. On this Sabbath, when an avalanche of red blood and fire pours forth from the God of gold on high. As now my tears stream forth unceasingly, over whom shall we weep first? Over the burned ones, over those beyond recognition, over those who have been crippled or driven senseless or smashed. I weep for them all. Now let us light the holy candles and mark the sorrow of Jewish masses in darkness and poverty. This, our funeral. These, our graves, our children. The beautiful, beautiful flowers destroyed. Our lovely ones burned. Their ashes buried under a mountain of caskets." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, chaplains in public schools. What do you think of the idea of putting chaplains in your local public schools? Evidently, this is being pushed in a number of states by conservatives who, you know, we got to get God back into schools. We need religion back in schools. And what you've got is you've got a number of these conservative states, approving this kind of legislation. You know, chaplain bills were approved by one legislative chamber in three states, Utah, Indiana, Louisiana. Died in Utah and Indiana, but pending in nine states. One passed both houses of the Florida legislature and waiting for DeSantis to sign it. So you've got bills introduced in like 14 states because we want chaplains. Now, the weird thing here is it would allow these chaplains to be hired by these school boards for whatever they want, whatever you want them to do, whatever you want. You want to get rid of those counselors, you know, the people who actually have training, get rid of them. Bring in the youth pastors. And I got to tell you, I see bad things coming with this. Now, for those who have beat me up over the years for predicting that we were moving towards a Christian version of Sharia law. For those of you who have sent me angry emails saying, how could you compare Christianity to those Muslims? Extremism is extremism. And if you give in to this kind of radical, what I think is radical extremism, bad things happen. Now, here's the part that's interesting to me. If we allow the chaplains to be in the schools, will we not have to have rabbis and, you know, clerics and other folks, other religious people in those positions? And does that not open the school districts up to, you know, like really big lawsuits and a lot of wasted time, energy, and resources? Yes, and that's the point. The point is, again, do everything you can do to handicap the public schools. To do everything you can do to starve them of resources. What do you think vouchers and cyber charters and charter schools are all about? It's all about starving the local public schools of their resources and privatizing education so that people can well, indoctrinate the children the way they want. And I get a kick out of people who say, well, I don't want the government teaching my kids. Having gone to public schools, it's really quite remarkable. And I guess, you know, the average American, I'm going to get in trouble for this. Maybe the average American who I spend too much time arguing with, maybe they're the best example of why maybe public schools don't work. But for the rest of us who did go through public schools and got a good education, are able to critically think and to rationally think and to reason because we had good teachers who cared. We had resources that were in place to make sure that our one opportunity to get that education was put to good use. Instead of what we see now, which are all just a bunch of gimmicks and trying to get resources out of public education. And a huge moneyed campaign to change people's minds about their local public schools. And I can't tell you how many people I talk to who are like, you know, well, my school's okay, my kids' teachers are good, but you know, it's those other ones, I've heard. You know, that's a win. It's a massive win for the anti-education crowd. Because they've already got you doubting. Well, I've heard in other schools. Yeah, I've heard too. Problem is the majority of that's not true. And it's this stuff that really tears us apart. Imagine, and this is the part that I'm struggling with, because I believe you have a freedom of religion. It's right there, number one. And I would argue freedom from religion, that you can practice whatever religion you want. I should be able to practice whatever I want, or none if I don't want. And if I don't want to, you shouldn't be able to impose your values and your views on me. And this is the part of the breakdown. I get my Christian Sharia law crowd who believes that we should be hammering this stuff, Ten Commandments in every wall. And as I've always said, look, I went to Catholic school as a young kid. I went to public school through high school. If you want to go that route, you should be able to. But you shouldn't be able to impose it on anyone else. If you want your children to pray and you want to pray with them, there's a place for that. It's in your home. It's in your church. It's not in the local public school with all of the other kids. It's not. And I know. But this is what I believe. I know. And you can believe that. But for everybody else, we don't have to come along. So this idea that they're going to start putting chaplains into public schools is crazy. It's just more of how far they'll go. And this is one of the questions that I've been banging around here lately. You know, if we give these religious conservatives, if we give this Republican Party what they want, if they get what they want, how far will they go? Because you may remember 10 years ago, probably even more than that, probably 15 years ago, I started saying, look, conservatives want to do away with Roe. They want to ban abortion. They want to make it criminal again. And then they're going to want to go after contraception. Then they're going to go after, you know, all of the, you know, the same sex marriage. They want to take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s. They want to repeal the 20th century and go back to the original intent of the Constitution without really the original intent. And the question I come back to is, you know, how far will they go? What else will they destroy? How much will they take in their perfect union that they have in their minds? They want to take away Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. They want to do away with the welfare state, any social safety net, do it away with. How far will they go? How much of America do they want to destroy so that they can have their version of what they believe this country should be? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. The Ricks.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.